And now it's time for the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.3 and www.freakradio.org. Like to ask listeners to have a pencil and paper handy, because you might hear something in the Earth First Update that would cause you to write it down. Yeah. Phone number, web page, email address, something like that. Anyway, here's the news for April 2nd, 2015. Start off with announcements. The State of the San Lorenzo River Symposium is going to be taking place Saturday, April 11th, right here at the Santa Cruz Civic Auditorium from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Join us for the State of the San Lorenzo River Symposium, a day of presentations and discussions about the health of the San Lorenzo River watershed. The event will be held at Santa Cruz Civic Auditorium, hosted by the City of Santa Cruz, the Coastal Watershed Council, and the Santa Cruz Fish and Game Commission. The discussion will be primarily focused on fisheries and water quality issues, though future similar events will delve into other important watershed issues. Breakfast and snacks will be provided. Please plan to bring your own lunch if you'd like to join us for the full day. Speakers include John Laird, Secretary for Natural Resources for the State of California, is the keynote speaker. Fred Keeley of the Open Space Project, and Rosemary Menard, Water Director for the City of Santa Cruz. And I understand there will be other speakers and presentations throughout the day. Once again, Saturday, April 11th from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. at the Santa Cruz Civic Auditorium, the State of the San Lorenzo River Symposium. And if you want more information, go to www.coastal-watershed.org. Here's the Buffalo Field Campaign's update from the field for this week. Hazing has begun in West Yellowstone. Spring migration of bison is underway in the Hebgen Basin here along Yellowstone's western boundaries. Approximately 300 buffalo have migrated into their traditional calving grounds. Sadly, things have become very difficult for the buffalo again. Buffalo Field Campaign has been running morning, afternoon, and night patrols monitoring migration, documenting hazing operations, and warning traffic of bison along the highway. Burning the candle at both ends, our incredible crew of volunteers is eager to do whatever it takes to help these gentle giants and tell their story. Three abusive hazing operations have already taken place along the South Fork of the Madison River near the Idaho border, just as buffalo calving season is about to begin. Hazing, or the aggressive forced removal of wild buffalo family groups, began on Friday and took place again on Sunday and Wednesday. Montana Department of Livestock inspectors and our local Montana Fish, Wildlife, and Parks game warden rudely chased buffalo family groups, including numerous pregnant buffalo on the cusp of giving birth, off their chosen ground, running them for miles through portions of the cattle-free Gallatin National Forest. This particular area on the south side of the Madison River is thickly riddled with fallen trees and is extremely dangerous to navigate. Even if you choose your steps carefully, buffalo aren't afforded this option. They are run through these areas, scared by yipping and yelling cowboys into moving, and often suffer injuries. As early in the season as it is, agencies have already begun bluff charging numerous times as the buffalo show resistance to this brutal bullying. More than 200 wild buffalo were abusively hazed in the past week. Across the Madison River to the north lies the Horse Butte Peninsula, a mountainous expression with large south-facing slopes where buffalo find good spring grass early in the year. Numerous family groups of buffalo are gracing this landscape where, for the most part, they'll be left alone until late May. When hazing begins on Horse Butte, it will be interesting to see how things play out, because late last May, Montana Governor Steve Bullock issued a directive to the Montana Board of Livestock stating that Montana Department of Livestock agents may no longer haze buffalo off of private property without the landowner's permission, something they have arrogantly ignored for more than a decade. Horse Butte residents are asking the Buffalo Field Campaign for more buffalo safe zone signs, which now carry greater legal backing. Buffalo-friendly landowners are in a strong position to help those gentle giants, and we look forward to supporting them, standing with the buffalo, and sending the wildlife abusers on their way. Buffalo Field Campaign has seasonal openings for field volunteers. We have opportunities for every season, but we are in great need of folks during our field season, which runs until late May. This is when wild bison are migrating into Montana, and any buffalo within Montana's borders is in danger of being hazed or captured and shipped to the slaughterhouse. All volunteers are provided with room, board, gear, and training in exchange for staffing our field patrols. We cater to most any dietary need and respect vegan, vegetarian, and roadkill diets. We are located in a log cabin on beautiful Hebgen Lake, just a few miles outside of West Yellowstone, Montana. And Uncle Dennis has to tell you that it is a remarkably beautiful and welcoming sight. Go to their webpage for information and contact info about volunteering with the Buffalo Field Campaign. You can send donations to the Buffalo Field Campaign at P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana, the zip code 59758. Their telephone number, 406-646-0070. And their webpage, which has all of this information and more. And specifically, if you're going to volunteer, read their webpage on volunteering very carefully, is www.buffalofieldcampaign.org. The Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And a third calf has been born to endangered orca population in this story by Victoria Cavalier, editing by Cynthia Johnson, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. A healthy days-old orca calf has been spotted with a pod of killer whales in the open waters of the U.S. Pacific Northwest, the third baby born to endangered population this winter, scientists have said. A research crew had been following the orcas to study their winter movements and feeding habits when scientists made the surprise discovery. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Fisheries Division said the whales were very grouped up, and within a few minutes we observed the new calf with its unique orangish color on the white areas. The calf looked very energetic, Brad Hansen, a NOAA biologist, said in an email from the research vessel. Scientists said it was the first time they have seen a baby born on the outer coast or Pacific Ocean waters and not in the more protected area of Puget Sound between Washington and British Columbia, where the orcas spend much of their time. It's important to see if it survives, but also to see if there's any difference or advantages to being born on the outer coast versus the inner sound, said NOAA spokesman Michael Milstein. The baby was the third born in 3 months, bringing to 80 the number of orcas living in the waters of the Pacific Northwest. Though the calf's birth was a hopeful sign, the orca population of the Pacific Northwest remains perilously low, experts said. Threats include environmental pollution and overfishing that has depleted their primary food source, Chinook salmon. Last year, the population lost 4 killer whales, including a pregnant female and a weeks-old calf. The federal research team has been following the highly intelligent and social marine mammals, the largest member of the dolphin family, to figure out where the southern resident killer whales go in the winter, what they eat when they leave the Puget Sound, NOAA said on a website about the project. The baby was first spotted off the coast near Westport, Washington, but over the past 2 weeks, the whales have been busy traversing a wide strip of ocean from southern Oregon to central Washington, scientists noted. The southern resident orcas are listed as endangered under both U.S. and Canadian law. The population has reached an almost record low this year, down from 98 in 1995 and well over 200 in the 19th century, according to the Center for Whale Research. And satellite data suggests that forest loss is accelerating in this story by Guile Plants, editing by Lori Gehring, World Environment News, Thomson Reuters. Satellite images suggest tropical forests from the Amazon to the Philippines are disappearing at a far more rapid pace than previously thought, a University of Maryland team of forest researchers say. The annual rate of deforestation from 1990 to 2010 was 62% higher than in the previous decade and higher than previous estimates, according to a study carried out of satellite maps covering 80% of the world's tropical forests. The new study suggests the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization's assessment, which suggested that the rate of deforestation actually decreased 25% from 1990 to 2010. Until now, the Forest Resource Assessment Report of the United Nations FAO was the only one available source to estimate long-term forest change and its trends, said Do-Hyung Kim, lead author of the study that is expected to be published in Geophysical Research Letters. However, the FAO report has been criticized for inconsistency in its survey methods and the definition of what is a forest. Our result is important in that we are providing a satellite-based alternative for the FRA, he said. The FAO assessment has been based in large part on self-reporting from tropical forest countries, Kim said. In contrast, Kim and his University of Maryland colleagues analyzed 5,444 Landsat images from 1990, 2000, 2005, and 2010 to assess how much forest was lost or gained by 34 countries, which account for about 80% of tropical forest land in the world. During the 1990 to 2000 time period, the annual net forest loss across all countries was 4 million hectares, or about 15,000 square miles, per year, according to the study. From 2000 to 2010, the net forest loss increased 62% to 6.5 million hectares, about 25,000 square miles, an area of forest clearing that size of the country of Sri Lanka every year. The study found that the study found that tropical Latin America showed the largest increase in annual forest losses, 1.4 million hectares, about 5,400 square miles per year, from the 1990s to the 2000s. Brazil topped the list with an annual 0.6 of a million hectare loss, about 2,300 square miles per year. Tropical Asia showed the second largest increase in deforestation with 800,000 hectares, about 3,100 square miles, lost per year, led by countries including Indonesia, Malaysia, Cambodia, Thailand, and the Philippines. Tropical Africa showed the least amount of annual net forest area loss, but still saw a steady increase due to primary cutting in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Madagascar. The UN's Forest Resource Assessment reported during the same period that there was a 25% decrease in deforestation in tropical forest countries. However, Rodney Keenan of the University of Melbourne forest science researcher who participated in the FAO's last forest assessment said the agency's report might not be as flawed as it seems. The Kim study uses automated remotely sensed imagery only, he said. This gives us a picture of one aspect of forest change, while ground estimates and management information give other perspectives, such as whether land without trees is set to be reforested. Most experts consider that relying on remote sensing alone, as these authors have done, is of limited value in understanding forest dynamics and managements, he said. Keenan agreed that both approaches could be considered complementary and that the new study presents interesting new data. However, Kim said the Forest Resource Assessment missed deforestation that is obvious in satellite images. For example, the FRA reported no change in deforestation rates in 16 of 34 countries looked at in both studies, including Colombia and the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The new study, however, found increasing deforestation in those countries, he said. Drivers of increased deforestation include an increase in urban population, logging, and growth of agriculture, according to research from NASA. Deforestation contributes about 10% of human-induced greenhouse gas emissions that drive global warming, studies suggest, which has led to a range of efforts to reduce the problem. And emergency protection for California's tricolored blackbirds. Tricolored blackbirds form the largest nesting colonies of any North American land bird, but their population has plummeted 63% over the past 6 years alone. The California Fish and Game Commission enacted emergency protections for the species recently in response to a Center for Biological Diversity petition listing the birds under the state's Endangered Species Act. Tricolored blackbirds once formed colonies of millions in the Central Valley of California, but have declined dramatically with the destruction of their wetlands and grassland homes. They're also being hurt by shooting and pesticides, as well as mowing and the harvest of certain cropland areas where they began nesting after their natural breeding sites were destroyed. The commission has finally heard the warnings from biologists and conservationists, said the center's Jeff Miller. It's crucial that harvesting and plowing activities on private lands used for tricolor breeding are prohibited or delayed during the upcoming 2015 nesting season, and that prohibitions on shooting are enforced. And red wolves are threatened with return to captivity. The Friday before the Labor Day weekend, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced an immediate evaluation of the country's only wild redwood population living in eastern North Carolina. Ostensibly, the review was meant to assess the ongoing reintroduction program, but it could fast become a convenient excuse for the service to throw in the towel on red wolves and pull the whole population from the wild. In 1998, the service gave up on a red wolf population it had similarly reintroduced to Great Smoky Mountains National Park. "We can't let that happen again. A return to captivity would devastate this unique wolf species that numbers hover around 100 wolves in the wild. It would also be a clear capitulation to special interests that seek their elimination." And a lawsuit has been launched to halt wildlife killing in Idaho. The Center for Biological Diversity and their allies launched a new legal challenge against Wildlife Services, the rogue federal program that kills millions of wild animals each year. Our latest action is a notice of intent to sue the program over its large-scale, often secretive work in Idaho. Last year, more than 3,000 coyotes, black bears, fishers, foxes, mountain lions, and other species were killed by Wildlife Services in that state using methods like aerial gunning, neck snares, traps, and exploding poison caps. We're asking the Wildlife Services to halt these lethal activities, including plans to destroy beaver dams with explosives that will harm endangered bull trout, until an adequate and up-to-date environmental analysis of the program's impacts is prepared. Grizzly bears, lynx, and bull trout are all suffering at the hands of Wildlife Services, and that needs to stop, said the center's new Idaho-based attorney, Andrea Santarcier. And three plants have won protection in the Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico. Three plants in the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico have just been protected under the endangered species, the latest beneficiaries of the center's historic 757 agreement, which has protected 136 species so far. Eggers agave is a stunning, long-lived, 20-foot-tall perennial plant with yellow blooms native only to the dry hillsides of eastern St. Croix in the U.S. Virgin Islands. We've been to court to protect the plant since 2004, and our work is now paying off. Island brittle leaf is a small evergreen shrub that grows in the forests of Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico manjack is a 16-foot large shrub that occurs in the southern part of the island. These remarkable plants have been pushed to the brink of extinction by land use practices, said Jacqueline Lopez, the center's Florida-based attorney, but the Endangered Species Act will make sure they are around for generations to come. If you need more information, go to www.biologicaldiversity.org. And the Sea Shepherd has given us some news here. An attempted suicide has been reported on board the poaching vessel Thunder as Nigeria strips its registry. Sea Shepherd calls on navies to intercept the slave ship. In a radio communication to the Sea Shepherd ships Bob Barker and San Simon, the captain of the Interpol wanted poaching vessel Thunder has reported that one of the deck crew, said to be Indonesian, has attempted suicide. The report comes in the wake of news that Thunder has been deregistered by its flag state Nigeria for violations of its registry condition, an action that means that the Thunder is now officially a stateless pirate vessel as defined by the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea. In the follow-up to the attempted suicide, the Sea Shepherd ship Bob Barker launched a small boat and attempted to deliver notes in plastic bottles to the Thunder's Indonesian deck crew. The notes stated that the Sea Shepherd ships are willing and equipped to take on board not only the injured crew member, but the entire deck crew of the Thunder. The notes were intercepted by officers on the Thunder who are believed to be of Spanish descent and thrown overboard. When the captain of the Thunder then radioed the Bob Barker and stated that an Indonesian crew did not want further communication with Sea Shepherd ships. Another man, said to be the Indonesian deck boss, then read a prepared statement in Spanish stating that the captain is a good person and that they did not want Sea Shepherd to deliver any more messages. An Indonesian speaker on board the Sam Simon then radioed the Thunder in Bahasa, a local Indonesian language, to verify the contents of the prepared Spanish statement. The The Thunder's captain responded, saying that the deck boss had gone to bed and that Sea Shepherd would not be able to speak to him again. Despite further requests for information, the captain of Thunder would not provide the name of the Indonesian deck boss or the name of the crewing agency responsible for hiring the deck crew. He also stated that the poaching vessel was equipped to remain at sea for another 9 months. The captain of the Bob Barker, Peter Hammerstedt, responded, repeating Sea Shepherd's offer to take the onboard the deck crew of Thunder. The captain of Thunder refused the offer. Captain Hammerstedt said, I firmly believe the Indonesian crew of the Thunder are trafficked persons under the United Nations Convention Against Transnational Organized Crime, specifically the Protocol to Prevent, Suppress, and Punish Trafficking in Persons, and the Protocol Against Smuggling of Migrants by Land, Sea, and Air. I also believe that they are being held against their will and know that they are not allowed to communicate freely. This is on board a vessel suspected of numerous fisheries crimes and one that has exhibited violent behavior toward my crew. The attempted suicide on board the Thunder and the captain's apparent intention to stay at sea gives me strong reason to worry about injury and death on board that vessel in the absence of government intervention. In light of these latest developments, Sea Shepherd has called upon support from the world's navies to intervene and apprehend the Thunder immediately. The captain of Sam Simon, Sid Chakravarti, said Article 99 of UNCLOS states that every state shall take effective measures to prevent and punish the transport of slaves in ships authorized to fly its flag and to prevent the unlawful use of its flag for that purpose. Further, Article 110 of UNCLOS empowers naval ships to board a vessel encountered on the high seas if there is, quote, reasonable grounds for suspecting that the vessel is without nationality or is engaged in the slave trade, unquote. The Thunder is now both without nationality and, in all reasonable assessments, must be considered to be engaged in slave trade in the name of human decency and in accordance with international law. Responsible governments must immediately send naval vessels to intervene and shut down this floating prison. The Bob Barker has been engaged in continuous pursuit of the Thunder for 100 days since it was first intercepted on December 17, 2014, on the Banzari Bank of Antarctica. This poaching vessel is the most notorious of the six remaining illegal, unregistered, and unreported vessels, which Sea Shepherd calls the Bandit Six, that are known to target vulnerable toothfish in the Southern Ocean. The vessels are the target of Sea Shepherd's 11th Southern Ocean Defense Campaign, Operation Icefish. The campaign commenced in December of last year as Sea Shepherd's longest continuous at-sea campaign to date. And a second internationally wanted toothfish poaching vessel, the Viking, has been detained in Malaysia. Another blow has been dealt to illegal fishing in the Southern Ocean with the detention of the Nigerian flag poaching vessel, Viking. In Malaysia, held for violations of Malaysia's maritime law, Malaysian authorities have indicated that the Viking will also be investigated for alleged illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing violations. The vessel was detained with 18 crew on board, one Chilean, two Peruvian, and 15 Indonesian citizens. The captain of the vessel, whose nationality is unknown, has been arrested. The Viking is one of the six remaining illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing vessels, which Sea Shepherd calls the Bandit Six. The Viking, like its five counterparts, has a long history of illegal fishing. In 2013, the vessel, then called the Snake, was the first vessel to be issued with an Interpol Purple Notice for fishing-related violations following a petition from authorities in Norway. Owners and operators of the vessel are suspected of violating national laws and regulations as well as international conventions by engaging in fraud and fisheries-related crimes. While Sea Shepherd applauds the detention of the Viking, the organization is now appealing to relevant authorities to ensure that the owners and officers of the vessel are prosecuted, the vessel scrapped, and its catch confiscated. And turning to the Earth First Newswire, this story entitled, Why I Am Still Sabotaging Fox Hunts 10 Years After They Were Banned, written by Lee Moon, as found in The Guardian. As a hunt saboteur, I spent every Saturday during the hunting season intervening to save wildlife. During August and September, when the hunts are training their young hounds to kill fox cubs, this means getting up at 3 a.m. to be in position for when they start their vile sport at dawn. Some people will ask, what motivates an ordinary person like me to devote so much of my spare time to this? Well, it's wrong to take the life of another being for pleasure. It's worse to call it a sport. And worse still, to use so many resources to make the odds so unfair. The fox doesn't stand much of a chance without intervention from hunt saboteurs. I started sabotaging hunts when I was 19, and hunting with hounds is still legal. When hunting with hounds was still legal, I had never considered myself an animal lover, but the idea of hunts ripping apart an animal in the name of sport struck me as unfair. I knew I had to try and stop it. While involved with an environmental group, I heard about hunt sabotage and went along to the meeting in the back room of a dingy pub. It was a whole new world, and I didn't understand much of what was being discussed, but I was determined to get involved. My first time out sabbing was a gruesome and memorable day. I was petrified in the morning as we set off and had little idea of what to expect. Luckily, other members of the group were reassuring and welcoming during the day. Despite our best efforts, the hunt killed a fox. We managed to retrieve the body and discovered they had killed a pregnant vixen. Two of the unborn cubs hanging out of her shredded body were still alive. There was nothing we could do, and the cubs quickly died. I was sickened. My stomach turns when I remember the beautiful creature and her vicious death. The hunters present seemed to think that this was acceptable. A few weeks later, our group intervened and saved a fox. We saw it running across a field and could hear the hounds in cry. One of the experienced sabs used horn calls to distract the hounds, giving the fox enough time to escape. I knew then I had to learn these skills. These two incidents made me realize how effective we could be, and that's why I'm still sabotaging hunts almost 20 years later. When the Hunting Act of 2004 became law in 2005, we thought we could hang up our sabbing boots and get on with our lives, but sadly, this is not the case. Hunters, while trying to portray respectability, decided to break the law repeatedly every week. Not the occasional accident, but full-on defiance. Furious at having their sport curtailed, hunters continue to chase and kill stags, foxes, hares, and minks. Hunting has been allowed to continue, largely unaffected by the Hunting Act, due to a lack of understanding and interest by the police, Crown Prosecution Service, and the judiciary. And unfortunately, that's all the time we have for the Earth First Update this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM at 9 p.m. You can listen to a rebroadcast on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 3 p.m. on Fridays. You can also listen to Radio Free Edmonton, as found on yegradio.wordpress.com. They rebroadcast this show 2 p.m. on Saturdays and 10 a.m. on Sundays, Mountain Time. When you get to yegradio.wordpress.com, click on Search and the radio schedule, and the listen links will come up. You can also listen to 90.3 KRFP Radio Free Moscow, Idaho, 9:30 on PM on Monday nights, or you could go to radioforall.net. That's radioforall.net online, where you can listen or download this or previous Earth First updates. The Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I'm Uncle Dennis, and I want to thank you for listening, and do tune in next Thursday evening for another edition of the Earth First Update.